This is VOA News via remote. I'm Tommy McNeil. Globally, more than 252,000 people have died from COVID-19, and there are more than 3.6 million confirmed cases. In the United States, approximately 70,000 people have died, and there are more than 1.2 million confirmed cases. Italy started stirring Monday, with millions of people allowed to return to work as Europe's longest coronavirus lockdown began to ease, while the U.S. took halting steps to lift some restrictions, even as tens of thousands of new cases were reported each day. In Washington, the U.S. Senate was convening for the first time since March, while dozens of people in Florida were waiting before sunrise for the 7 a.m. opening of the Clearwater Beach. In South Dakota, a shuttered pork processing plant took its first steps toward reopening after more than 800 employees were infected with coronavirus. Louisiana lawmakers were also restarting their legislature, even as they feuded over whether they should return at all. U.S. regulators are revising a policy that has allowed coronavirus blood tests to reach the U.S. market without first providing proof that they worked. The move Monday by the Food and Drug Administration follows criticism that the lack of oversight created a wild west of unregulated tests. Under the new policy, companies with test kits for sale will be required to submit information on their test accuracy within 10 days. The blood tests are designed to show who has had a coronavirus infection in the past and may have some immunity. Most use a fingerprint of blood during a test strip. Find more at voanews.com. This is VOA News. Amid more defiance from local governments, California Governor Gavin Newsom said that some businesses can reopen as early as Friday with restrictions to help prevent the spread of the coronavirus. The plan under the second phase of the governor's four-point reopening plan allows retailers such as clothing stores, sporting goods, and florists to resume operations with curbside pickup. According to Reuters, an internal Chinese report warns that Beijing faces a wave of hostility in the wake of the coronavirus outbreak that could tip relations with the United States into confrontation. People familiar with the paper told Reuters that global anti-China sentiment is in its highest since the 1989 Tiananmen Square crackdown. Reuters couldn't determine what extent the stark assessment reflects positions held by China's state leaders and to what extent it would influence policy. But the presentation of the report shows how seriously Beijing takes the threat of building backlash. Relations between China and the U.S. were fraught with before the outbreak, and with deepening mistrust and friction points from U.S. allegations of unfair trade and technology practices to disputes over Hong Kong, Taiwan, and contested territories in the South China Sea. Israel's Supreme Court on Monday heard challenges to Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's bid to secure a governing coalition. Opposition figures argued that forming a new administration would unlawfully shield him from a corruption trial. They've also challenged Netanyahu's authority to form a government given his indictment on charges of bribery, fraud, and breach of trust. Should the court find against Netanyahu on either front, it would trigger a snap election. And that would be the fourth time Israelis are forced back to ballot boxes since April 2019, all while the country grapples with the coronavirus crisis and its economic fallout. Netanyahu and his main rival, Benny Gantz, signed an agreement last month to form a unity government under which they would take turns leading Israel. Right-wing Netanyahu would serve as prime minister for 18 months before handing the reins to centrist Gantz. Netanyahu would then assume the role of substitute prime minister. But some analysts say that would exempt him from a law that requires high-level ministers to resign from public office if they are indicted on criminal charges. The coalition's deal also grants Netanyahu influence over important judicial appointments, which critics argue gives the prime minister undue sway over the outcome of his own proceedings. Netanyahu's trial is due to open on May 24th. He has denied any wrongdoing and accused political rivals of a witch hunt. Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America and James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, May 5th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Uganda's president eases some COVID-19 measures, but says all Ugandans must wear masks when not in their homes.
We are going to make it mandatory for everybody who is not in his or her house to wear a cloth face mask covering all the time, the mouth and the nose.
Liberia's President George Weah receives a consignment of alleged COVID-19 cure from Madagascar. Human Rights Watch criticizes China for alleged ill treatment of Africans. Zambia's commitment to curb COVID-19 spread comes under criticism. The UN calls for investigation into an attack against Malian refugees. And Lesotho's parliament gives Prime Minister Thomas Thabane a Saturday deadline to resign.
We wanted him to leave beginning of this month. If he doesn't leave today and tomorrow the king signs the amendment to the constitution, I think we will help him leave the office before Saturday.
Montelentwa Lepsa is the deputy leader of Lesotho's opposition Democratic Congress Party. A women's rights group cheered the criminalization of FGM in Sudan. But some say more needs to be done. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Ugandans will now have to wait at least 14 more days before the country's COVID-19 lockdown is lifted. Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni has come out with new measures aimed at easing the lockdown. Speaking Tuesday evening, the president added some essential services that he said will be allowed to operate, including wholesalers, hardware stores, lawyers, and restaurants. He also mandated that Ugandans wear masks whenever they are in the public. Reporter Mugumi Davis Rakaringi has more from Kampala.
In his address to the nation this Monday, President Museveni says he will, in 2 quotes, start slowly and carefully open up without undoing the achievements Uganda has had in mitigating the spread of coronavirus disease in the country. Consequently, the president added on the list of essential workers, including lawyers, mechanics, artisans, as well as insurance brokers.
Accordingly, we shall allow the wholesalers to open. However, the wholesalers will observe the social distancing rules. The seller must be 2 meters from the customer, but should be protected with a mask, and the customers must be 4 meters apart. Also allowed to open are the hardware shops, so that they sell factory goods, but also supply the construction sites.
Restaurants will only be allowed to provide takeaway services, and employers have been instructed to provide transport for their workers. The president says the lockdown has helped Uganda to make better preparations in the fight against the spread of COVID-19.
The local factories are either manufacturing the face masks and the personal protective equipment, or are in the process of manufacturing them. We now have the capacity to make a large number of masks. The local factories, 38 of them, are now making enough quantities of sanitizers, because that one also was a problem at the beginning.
He also said the government has opened many treatment and isolation centers, as well as collection points of testing samples for people suspected of coronavirus. All people will be mandated to wear masks whenever they appear in public.
We are going to make it mandatory for everybody who is not in his or her house to wear a cloth face mask covering all the time, the mouth and the nose. Why? It is because, remember, the virus rides on the droplets.
The president once again applauded citizens for adhering to government measures aimed at preventing the spread of coronavirus in the country. So far, 89 people in Uganda have tested positive for coronavirus after the first case was announced in late March. Over 50 of them have since recovered and been discharged from hospitals. For VOA News, I am Mugume Davis Rakaringi in Kampala, Uganda.
Liberia is the latest African country to accept the use of an alleged coronavirus treatment from Madagascar. Liberian President George Weah received an initial consignment of the Madagasi anti-COVID-19 herb in Monrovia on Monday after he said he agrees with Madagascar President André Rajoelina to test the alleged treatment. President Weah expressed confidence in Africa's potential to find solutions to the global pandemic. Moses Gazia reports from Monrovia.
Why scientists around the globe are clamoring to find a possible cure for the coronavirus pandemic, it appears more and more African countries are inclined to accepting and allege Madagascar herb as a possible cure for the COVID-19. Liberia has become the latest African country to approve the use of the Madagascar herb, which has not yet been approved by the World Health Organization. President George Weah received the first consignment of the Madagascar anti-COVID-19 herb yesterday, Monday, at the Rabat International Airport.
My good friend, Sosoko Ambalo, president of himself, called me 2 days ago and told me he was sending coronavirus preventive and cure message. And I'm glad that he dispatched his people.
The Liberian leader commended the president and people of Madagascar for taking the lead in finding what he called preventive and curable medicine for the novel coronavirus.
We want to thank the people of Madagascar and His Excellency Andreas Rajoelina for his goodwill to our country. And we hope that they will cure those affected by coronavirus.
The World Health Organization has since dismissed claims that the Madagascar herbal tonic produced and cured COVID-19 patients. But Liberia Minister of State Nathaniel Magill defended why the alleged Madagascar herbal treatment should be given a chance. Magill says people in rural areas in Africa have successfully treated illnesses with herbs.
They're taking African herb, and we are African. We believe in our traditional medicine, and so this is good. Right now, you go in all the people who they're drinking lime tea, they're drinking this, they're boiling this, they're doing that, and they're taking medicine. So these are good things. Wow.
Liberia has now accumulated 158 confirmed COVID-19 cases with 18 deaths and 58 recoveries. President Weah has meanwhile issued a 60-day state of emergency that is ongoing. Moses Gazel, VOA News, Monrovia.
Human Rights Watch is calling on the Chinese government to end what it calls racial discrimination against Africans and people of African origin living in China during the COVID-19 pandemic. But as Maureen Ojiambo reports from Nairobi, the Chinese Foreign Ministry has denied singling out foreigners.
Early last month, Chinese authorities in the southern city of Guangzhou, which has China's largest African community, began a mandatory campaign to test Africans for the coronavirus. Landlords then evicted African residents, forcing many to sleep on the streets as hotels, shops, and restaurants refused to attend to African customers. Yekung Wang, Chinese researcher at Human Rights Watch, said that the Chinese authorities visited homes of African residents, testing them on the spot or instructing them to take a test at a hospital, a treatment that other foreign groups were not subjected to.
Chinese authorities began a campaign to forcibly test Africans for the coronavirus. Most importantly, the policy is racist and discriminatory, because why are only Africans targeted? Why not other groups? I mean, this is a question that Africans right now in China who have been tested asked, why are only us? Why not everybody else if it's targeting foreigners?
Wang said most imported cases of COVID-19 to Guangzhou were Chinese nationals returning from abroad, and that many Africans had already tested negative for the virus.
People who are abroad and who are going back to China who might carry the virus, most of them are Chinese nationals living abroad. Secondly, the policy completely disregard that whether the foreigners in China have any contact with people who are infected or have recent travel history.
In a statement released by the Chinese government yesterday, Sunday, Chinese Foreign Ministry denied that China had been singling out foreigners. Karin Kaneza, African Advocacy Director at the Human Rights Watch, said that Chinese has denied the allegations despite the reports with evidence on social media.
The Chinese government has denied discriminating against Africans in Gwangju, saying that, and I quote, it rejects differential treatment and has zero tolerance for discrimination. It's important to also recognize that what's been happening in Gwangju is part of a wider pattern of racial discrimination. The fact that even before the COVID-19 pandemic erupted, the police frequently targeted Africans.
According to Human Rights Watch, about 14,000 African nationals live in Gwangju. Reports of discrimination against Africans in China triggered anger among African communities around the world, as several African governments, including Nigeria, Uganda, and Ghana, summoned Chinese ambassadors in their countries to protest. Reporting for VOA's Daybreak Africa, I am Maureen Ojiambo in Nairobi, Kenya.
You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, May 5th. The Zambian government is coming under criticism over its commitment to curb the spread of the coronavirus. This after local media reported the death of a health worker who was carrying test specimens of suspected COVID-19 using public transport. Opposition and civil society groups are demanding an independent investigation and the firing of health officials, including the health minister. The ruling party supporters rejected the criticisms. They say the government continues to demonstrate commitment to halt the spread of the disease. Judith Mulenga, vice chairperson for the Civil Society Constitutional Agenda, says it is unacceptable for health officials to allow a public vehicle to be used in transporting COVID-19 specimens.
The calling for the investigation into the accident that took place, and also the fact that there was an health employee carrying test samples from one district, one town to another on a public bus is absolutely necessary. The government should explain, should investigate and explain why a health employee was carrying specimens on a public vehicle. These vehicles are normally very crowded and there are all sorts of people on these vehicles. The area in which the accident happened has not been yet classified as an epicenter of the COVID. So therefore, people were traveling in a much freer fashion than those of us who live in epicenters where we try as much as possible to adhere to the public health guidelines. So I can imagine that the passengers on the bus were not wearing masks. And even if the accident did not happen, and this person is carrying suspected highly infectious specimens on a public bus, any mishandling of that could cause untold infection rates to spike in the country to these unsuspecting public on a public vehicle.
Judith, what is the stance of your organization following reports that officials of the health ministry say they had to resort to public transportation because they don't have enough vehicles to do so?
That response from the health officials of not having enough vehicles is absolutely nonsensical. It's unacceptable, and no public officer can actually give that as an excuse. This disease, it's classified among the infectious diseases. When it broke, the Minister of Health issued a statutory instrument in which he announced that the COVID is regarded as a highly epidemic infectious disease and issued guidelines on how the public should behave and should prevent from themselves from getting infected. And if it's an infectious, highly epidemic infectious disease, the government has been receiving funds to help with the fight of this COVID-19. And people have been demanding to know, I've been demanding for accountability, to know how much has been donated to Zambia and what it's being used for. So therefore, the excuse of a vehicle for such a highly contagious disease and somebody carrying specimens on a public bus where all sorts of age groups are is highly unacceptable and can only be spoken in a country where public officials are not accountable for their jobs.
The accident, some Zambians argue, shows the government's lack of commitment towards limiting the spread of the coronavirus in Zambia. Do you think the assessment is justified or fair?
The assessment is justified because it's such a dreadful incident to happen in a country when the very government has invoked a section of special provisions regarding formidable endemic diseases. And this section is in our Public Health Act, and it classified the COVID as a formidable epidemic, endemic, or infectious disease.
Judith Mulenga is vice chairperson for the Civil Society Constitutional Agenda of Zambia. She was speaking with the VOA's Peter Clotty from Lusaka. The deputy leader of Lesotho's main opposition Democratic Congress Party says Mbatho Prime Minister Thomas Thabane must leave office by this Saturday, May 9th, or the parliament would help him leave. Motaletu Alepsa says the prime minister has had many chances to step down. Mr. Thabane has been under immense pressure from within his own All Basotho Convention Party to resign following the 2017 murder of his former wife, for which he and his current wife are said to be allegedly implicated. Some of Thabane's supporters say the prime minister should be given a dignified exit, including even an immunity from prosecution. Parliament gave the prime minister an ultimatum to step down by this Saturday. Motalentwa Lepsa says to give the prime minister an immunity would set a bad example for future leaders.
The prime minister has to leave. It is not that the call is made for the first time now. We have been tracking this, I think, from as early as last year, somewhere September. Up to now, we've been calling for his resignation. He's adamant he wants to live on his own terms, but we are also adamant that he should leave the office earlier than end of this week.
What happens if he does not leave on Saturday?
As I said, Saturday may be too long a time for him to leave. We wanted him to leave beginning of this month. If he doesn't leave today and tomorrow the king signs the amendment to the constitution, I think we will help him leave the office before Saturday.
Some of the prime minister's staunch supporters have suggested that he should be treated with respect, especially as founder of the All Basotho Convention Party.
Well, treating the prime minister with respect is something, really. We are politicians. We have respected him by calling for his resignation without pushing him out of the office. There are avenues we can employ to make sure that he leaves the office. But we have been asking him to leave the office voluntarily. He doesn't want to leave. So we have to employ other ways to make sure he leaves.
Of course, and as you know, the prime minister faces a possible prosecution after he leaves office because of the allegations about the death of his estranged wife. Some of his supporters want assurances that he will get immunity. Are you willing to give him immunity?
Well, you can be sure that none of the parliamentarians wants to see him getting immunity. That would be setting a very bad precedent. Somebody is misbehaving in the public office with the hope that when they leave the office, they'll be immune from prosecution. That would be a bad precedent, really. So you can be sure that nobody would like to go that route. If there is anything he has to go and answer, he should go to courts and answer. If he hasn't done anything, the courts will acquit him. But if he has done something, he will have to convince the courts that he's not guilty. If he's guilty, he is like any other citizen in Lesotho. So what?
What do you say to those who argue that what is happening right now to Prime Minister Thabane is exactly one of the reasons why some African leaders don't want to leave power?
Some African leaders don't want to leave office because they misbehaved when they were in the office. So they know that once they leave that office, they are going to be very vulnerable. So they will cling to power as long as possible.
Montalentwa Lepsa is the deputy leader of Lesotho's opposition Democratic Congress Party. He was speaking with us from the capital, Maseru. The United Nations Refugees Agency is calling for an investigation into a violent attack against Malian refugees on May 2nd by Burkina Faso security forces, which left dozens injured, many seriously. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Security forces reportedly burst into the Mentau refugee camp a day after Burkina Faso soldiers came under fire by one of the many armed groups operating in the region. One soldier reportedly was killed, and another has gone missing. UN Refugee Agency spokesman Baba Balach tells VOA security forces barged into the camp looking for so-called armed elements whom they blamed for the attack which occurred on a nearby highway.
So they went in into this refugee camp asking men and boys to come out, then beating them, mistreating them. We have more than 32 refugees in the hospital right now being taken care of. So this is what we are condemning, this violence, and we are asking the authorities, one, to investigate, other, to protect the refugees.
There's been no response from the Burkina Faso government. Mentau camp is close to Burkina Faso's border with Mali in the volatile Sahel region. It houses some 6,500 refugees, most of them women and children. Witnesses have told UNHCR staff that refugees accused of complicity with the unidentified gunmen were given an ultimatum to leave the camp within 72 hours or face death. Balart says the refugees are living in fear of their lives. He says the UNHCR is reiterating its appeal to the government of Burkina Faso to let its staff move the refugees to a safer location.
UNHCR was forced by insecurity to relocate our staff in November 2019. And since then, our access to the location has been really sporadic. That's one reason we are urging the authorities to help us relocate, to move these refugees to a safer place where we can help them better.
Balach says the situation in the camp is untenable. He says the refugees are living in dire conditions. He also notes that insecurity has forced schools, the health center, and security post in the camp to close. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Last week, women and girls' rights activists in Sudan celebrated a legal victory after the country criminalized female genital mutilation, or FGM. Women's groups in Sudan, who were vital to last year's regime change, paved the way for the criminalization. Equality Now's Sudan director Faiza Mohammed tells Ricky Shryak that there are still many laws and practices that the groups have their sights on to improve women's and girls' rights in Sudan.
We think that there might be some delay, but the negotiation can start, and we can start trading some basic, product that related to fighting the COVID-19. In terms of the negotiation, I think the African Union is working now to find a way to convene all ministers of trade virtually for a discussion and to see how they could start the negotiation. So I think it will slow down, but we strongly believe that the CFTA can be the best stimulus for Africa.
And why do you think it will make the best stimulus for Africa?
There is now, a mindset from many African private sector and African leaders about the importance to accelerate the process of African trading among themselves. When you see the opportunities that we have, I mean, just to give you a couple of numbers, Africa imports for food stuff. The total bill is close to $35 billion. Many of these products can be produced in Africa. There is production capacity at this point, but many of these products can be sourced from Africa. There are people producing.
Faiza Mohammed is the head of Equality Now's Sudan office. She was speaking to Ricky Stryer from Nairobi, Kenya. And that's it for this Tuesday, May 5th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Barty in Washington, wishing you a very good day.